Sam, good morning.
Good morning, Frank.
Sam, first of all, the story at the moment, and we've touched on it over the last hour or so, and it's in the news and whatever, of that admission from the Secretary of State not knowing about voting patterns in Northern Ireland. Was it careless of her to admit that?
I think that most people in politics would certainly say it was careless. I think that there are two ways of looking at this. Either she was being very truthful or she was being... Too truthful, if you like. She was saying what politicians would say is maybe wiser not to reveal if indeed she didn't know this. I think that on one level, somebody coming in from outside Northern Ireland, clearly there are all sorts of nuances to politics here which they could not be expected to know, and there is no embarrassment or shame in that. I suppose the nature of what she admitted, that, you know, a unionist would never vote for a nationalist and vice versa. It is such a basic fact of politics, not just in Northern Ireland, but in any area of the UK. Generally, if you have a very firm political view, for instance, people who are Scottish National Party voters, it's difficult to shift that. Now, it's certainly true to say that it's not impossible, and the SNP has taken votes from Labour over recent years and vice versa at various points. But certainly in a Northern Ireland context, coming in here and also coming in at a point where she did come in, where there was a major crisis at Stormont. James Brookenshire had to leave very suddenly because of his health problems. And really, she was being thrust into the eye of a storm. And I suppose the question then is also for Theresa May as to the wisdom of appointing somebody who knew so little about the situation that really she was coming in completely cold. And there was a period where she was presumably, to a certain extent, at the mercy of her officials who were briefing her and really telling her what was going on. So she certainly has been very candid here. I think arguably one of the more significant things that she says in this interview with Parliament's In-House magazine is that there is no alternative, in her view, to restoring devolution. And that is very significant at this point, because if there's no alternative to Stormont, and if the DUP and Sinn Féin will not go into Stormont for their own reasons, that really suggests that there is no plan B for the government. Businesses who are looking in on things at the moment, hoping for some certainty, hoping for clarity around planning decisions and all manner of Stormont decision making, they're really not going to take much comfort from that. And I think that is perhaps more significant than the embarrassing aspect of admitting that really she didn't really know very much about us when she arrived.
So you don't really need a Secretary of State who's going to know a huge amount about it if we're prepared to live in limbo land then?
Well, I suppose, I mean, there are two ways of looking at this. Any politician, for the most part, with a handful of exceptions, they are really generalists. So when you put somebody in to be the health minister, whether it's in Westminster or whether it's in Scotland or whether it's in Dublin or Northern Ireland, they don't necessarily need to know anything about medicine. But I suppose the difference here is that you would expect them to have some vague sense as to how the NHS works and what a GP is and various things like that. So Karen Bradley couldn't be expected to know everything, but the fact that really at the very basic level, she'd never been here, she said, she didn't understand some of these really quite elementary aspects of politics in Northern Ireland. It certainly suggested that she wasn't, I suppose, the other way of spinning it, if you like, is that she wasn't coming here with any baggage. She really just had no knowledge of the situation whatsoever. And I mean, some people, I suppose, have argued that what we need is somebody coming in from outside as an independent mediator who really is completely outside what's gone on here. That has happened in the past with George Mitchell, with Sir Ninian Stephen at one point, the former Governor General of Australia. So sometimes that can be quite helpful. But I think in the context of a Secretary of State who is making enormous decisions, very sensitive decisions about whether to implement direct rule, about whether to take individual decisions through Parliament, about the talks with the DUP and Sinn Féin, the idea that at that point you would put somebody in who knows that little about things is, I suppose, either a pretty bold move or a pretty reckless move by the Prime Minister.
Does her salary go up significantly when she gets into the Cabinet?
It does. I'm now struggling to recall exactly what it is, but certainly it's a healthy financial position. I think that the context of this is that Karen Bradley is somebody who is very close to Theresa May. There is a wider political context to this. It's not simply about appointing somebody who is the best person for the Northern Ireland job. It's about appointing somebody, A, who will take the post, because there are some people who really see it as the lowest rung in the ladder. So you're not going to get somebody like Philip Hammond to be persuaded to come here as the Chancellor. It'd be a big step down. But also, there was an imperative for the Prime Minister at that point, given her pretty perilous personal position within the Tory party, to have people around her who were loyal. And Karen Bradley is a friend of Theresa May. She worked with her closely in the Home Office. And as with James Brokenshire, there was a close personal bond there between these two people. So I think that will have been a significant factor in her coming to Northern Ireland, and perhaps more of a significant factor than any knowledge that she might have had about how Northern Ireland operates politically or in any other way.
Sam, tell me this. You see politicians all the time. You're surrounding yourself with them. You're quizzing them. You're writing about them, for better or for worse. It seems to me like a miserable existence to be a politician. Maybe I'm just looking in on RHI at the moment, and I'm sure Jonathan Bell regrets the day and hour he ever stood for election. And the other people who are being referred to, when you see the banner headlines about how politicians are being scrutinised, they must have really thick skin, or they must have some sort of lust for power that makes them want to do what they do. I know I couldn't do it. Could you do it?
Certainly not. I think that there actually is a serious problem here that you have put your finger on, and that is that politics is increasingly something which I think to a lot of people, they are not interested in entering. They don't want to be involved in it. There is a particular issue in Northern Ireland, obviously, where some people are just turned off by what they see as the tribalism, the sectarianism of Stormont politics, rather than dealing with day-to-day issues. But even in places like Westminster and in the Doyle, there is a real difficulty in attracting people to politics. Now, you will always get people into politics because there is enormous power which comes with being at the top of the tree in a government system, whatever that system is. These are people who have enormous patronage to hand out. They get to decide where roads are built, where hospitals are built. They have all sorts of decision-making powers, and that is very attractive to people. And it's one of the reasons why, even though politics to maybe the man in the street seems like a very well-paid profession, it's actually, in comparison to some of the jobs that these people have had as lawyers or doctors or whatever, it's actually not terribly attractive financially. But one of the things that is very attractive about it is the power aspect of it. But I think there is a difficulty where some people who could contribute quite considerably and could give their talents to helping to run the health service, to helping to run the Department of Justice or various aspects of government, are really turned off the whole thing, partly because of the scrutiny, partly because it is seen as just such a brutal and such an unpleasant profession in some ways, somewhere where you can't even trust the people who are closest to you in your own party. In fact, sometimes the people in your own party are the people that you should be the most wary of, because they're trying to get your job. And really, some people just look into that and say, it's not worth it. I don't want this. I want to stick with what I know.
If you needed proof of what you're saying, just follow the RHI inquiry. Looking at the headlines this morning, Belfast Telegraph, a monster that had to be put to sleep. That was a comment that was made about Jonathan Bell. Another headline that says, Bell tells RHI inquiry he heard explicit details of DUP minister's sexual misbehaviour. That's the front story on the Irish News. The other one is the front story on the Belfast Telegraph. And the front on your paper, written by yourself, Sam, Bell admits letter for £76,000 post was false. The scrutiny at RHI, especially whenever there's a famous face sitting in on the big red sofa, it's so intense, and it seems to go on forever. What are you expecting today?
Well, Mr. Bell is back today. He's giving testimony now. I think he'll be there for the rest of the day. I think he may well be back after today, even though that's not scheduled. But the inquiry was going through things at a fairly slow pace yesterday. And one of the issues yesterday was that Jonathan Bell was making very significant allegations. He was using quite colourful language at points that claim, obviously, which has made the headlines in the Irish news, about DUP ministers who he had been discussing with his special advisor. He said their sexual misbehaviour, that isn't terribly relevant to what the RHI inquiry is doing, and the chairman intervened and said, well, look, we're not getting into that here, let's get back on track. But one of the difficulties for the inquiry is trying to really tie him down in the detail of what he knew, of what meetings he was in, of what was told to him, of what he wasn't told, and really trying to test, I suppose, how clear is his memory of what is going on here. So he has made very serious allegations about what happened. He's claiming that DUP special advisors tried to really delay cost controls, that they did that out of personal financial gain, or out of personal gain for family members in some cases. But really, what the inquiry is trying to do is trying to establish, is that credible? Is it something which Jonathan Bell can give us clear and precise information about? Or is this just a sense which he developed? And is it that he is somebody who really, I suppose, isn't across the detail of things, as his special advisor has alleged to the inquiry, somebody who wasn't reading ministerial submissions, Mr. Bell's former special advisor has alleged. Mr. Bell denied that yesterday. He said he was somebody who was very engaged in these issues and that these issues were being deliberately hidden from him. But that's one of the issues which was slightly frustrating the panel yesterday, where they were trying to get him to answer some quite basic questions about, in some cases, even what year something happened in, and Mr. Bell was really dancing all around the issue and really not answering the question, and that was leading to a pretty slow pace through some of the questions yesterday.
And finally, Sam, do you think the tabloids will chase him for that story that the head of the inquiry said wasn't relevant to RHI?
I'm sure they may well do, and it's certainly not something that I'll be chasing him for, but I think that the nature in which he presented that to the inquiry is quite significant. He didn't suggest that he had any evidence for this. He didn't suggest that he had personal knowledge of any of this, which he alleged, in terms of sexual misbehaviour by two DUP ministers. It was really presented as gossip between him and his special advisor. And there is one significant aspect to this, potentially, where Mr. Bell says that it was his special advisor who raised the issue. He says it was inappropriate and really it shouldn't have been raised with him. Mr. Kearns, who was his special advisor, says the opposite. He says Mr. Bell raised it with him. And more than that, he says that Mr. Bell raised it with him because it was told to him by someone. And that really opens up a slightly different line of inquiry as to who was telling Mr. Bell these things, if that was right. But I think that really the context in which Mr. Bell presented that to the inquiry yesterday was pretty vague. It wasn't the sort of thing where he was coming forward and saying, I can prove that this happened. So I'm not sure that we should take that terribly seriously unless we can get more information that proves it or really disproves it either way.
Okay. Sam McBride, thank you very much indeed. Sam McBride is the political editor with the newsletter.